There we go, there we go. All right. It is the last session of Tech Ed.
Are you still awake?
All right. Here's what I want to do, because we got to have some fun. We're getting ready to go to Universal. We got to be woken up and ready to rock and roll tonight. I want to disrupt every other session nearby us. Do you mind? So I need three volunteers from this side of the room. Three. I want Cornholio. Two and three. Come on up to the front. You guys will get these fantastic IE9 stickers as a reward for your leadership today. One, two, three. And on this side of the room, three volunteers. One, two, three. All right, so real, real simple. This side of the room over here, you guys are the geeks. This side over here, you guys are the nerds. All we want to do is have a contest to see who shouts the loudest, the geeks or the nerds. So on one, two, three, geeks!
Geeks!
One, two, three,
nerds!
Now leaders, lead.
One, two, three, geeks!
One, two, three, nerds!
I think the nerds won. All right. Now we're getting warmed up here. All right, so this session is officially called App Compat for Nerds. I'll kind of call it improvisational debugging just to have some fun. But kind of like Schoolhouse Rock, you might learn something along the way. What I wanted to do is kind of like death by PowerPoint. So we can start with that, but what I thought might be an even better idea was to not show another PowerPoint the rest of the time that we're here, if that's okay. And last but not least, we'll just have a brief word from our sponsors.
Hi there. We're here at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, where in the night, we secretly replaced this patient's blood with IE9.
Excuse me?
We wanted to find out if, after injection of IE9, he indeed became faster, cleaner, and more trusted. So first we'll see if Steven is faster as a result of IE9. Steven, can you please run down to the hospital entrance and back, please?
Fantastic editing, isn't it? I should be a special effects guy.
Steven is now faster. Actually, that could come in handy. Steven, could you quickly run back to Redmond? I forgot my phone there.
Let me know when you're gone.
All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
All right, now, Steven.
Yes, sir.
You are indeed faster. We now want to see if you are cleaner, right? Because one of the big benefits of IE9 is it gets out of your way. You don't even see the browser there. So let's see if that works. Right? All right, let's see. My God, where did he go? Steven!
I'm here!
I don't even see him. Are you still there?
I am still here.
Completely invisible. So indeed, Steven is now cleaner. All right, so we've seen that Steven is indeed faster. He is cleaner. But the question is he now more trusted? So to try that out, we're going to give Steven the entirety of my child's college savings fund. Steven, here you go. You can just have that.
Chris, I can't take this.
No, you can have it.
I appreciate it, but this is yours. You should take it back.
Ladies and gentlemen, is a trustworthy person.
Might I also recommend a good financial advisor if that is the complete nest egg that you currently have?
Internet Explorer 9. So you can be this guy.
Internet Explorer 9. Now with Tiger Blood. And on to the debugging. So what we're going to talk about is app compat for Windows, for IE, and really how to understand how to troubleshoot these things. I will be taking some of the cases that were nasty and gnarly. I will be taking things that are relevant and try to tie it back to the themes. What I don't want to do, if there's anyone here who is kind of just getting started and wanting to know what App Compat is all about, this is not representative. I have intentionally chosen some of the hardest things I could find on purpose to show you that the same process that you use to solve the easy stuff can be used to solve the hard stuff. And it's really important to be thinking about that process, which is don't just sit there poking at things with tools. The deeper the tools go, the more time you can waste. I have wasted 36 consecutive hours in a debugger before, poking around. It's a It's a great way to waste all kinds of time. The having a structured approach is the only reasonable way to do that, to be thinking of where is it that I'm starting from, what's the symptom, what's my best guess, build a hypothesis, what do I think is wrong? Until I have a guess as to what's wrong, I shouldn't be using a tool, right? Or certainly not a debugging tool. Maybe I'm using something to kind of stir up the hornet's nest and see if it's still alive, but I'm not chasing the answer yet. Hypothesis. What tool will answer that question? And to be mindful of the fact that I want to look for the easiest answer to that question, not necessarily the deepest. Yes, sir? Process Explorer. That's just the answer. When in doubt, use Harry Procmon. See, I can even steal Aaron's jokes. Is Aaron still here? Oh, good. I'm using all of them now because he won't even know. All right, so to fire things up, I figured I would start with a website that one or two of you might have seen so far this week. Oh, that's fantastic. All of these are live public websites, and if they suck, I may end up in trouble. So TechEd.com is down right now. That's probably really good for reviews and giving feedback, isn't it? Probably, I suspect Mark Rusinovich. Interesting. Hey, I got the feedback for my session. Let's make sure nothing else can come out. All right. Well, like I said, improvisational debugging. The point I intended to show, and perhaps we'll come back and show it later, was the one that talks about the configuration, when things are configured in a way that you're intentionally breaking yourself. What about when things are configured in a way that you are not broken? How do we fix that? So let's take another debugging example, and this is a fun one. This was a real customer application. I hope they're not here to be embarrassed. But I'm going to troubleshoot a web application. And this web application was a real, honest-to-goodness, live public web application. And illustrate how we can use Fiddler to resolve that problem. How many of you are familiar with Fiddler? So a lot of you. How many of you consider yourselves proficient with Fiddler? How many of you use it to gather bug repros? Right? Awesome, awesome tool for gathering bug reproductions. There is, in fact, a tool available called FiddlerCap. It's at FiddlerCap.com that will go through, see how Eric Lawrence can keep his websites running? It can go through and give you a tool to just gather web information, collect it all up, package it up, and send it back in so that you're not sticking. That's WinDBG. That's nothing like Fiddler. So you're not sticking this tool in front of an end user because this usually ends up to people going, wow, really? I'm kind of horrified and terrified by it. So with Fiddler Cap, we can gather information about the application, and with the Fiddler proxy, we can play that information back. It's one of the most powerful aspects of this tool is that it allows me to take a situation where I have information coming in, but I can modify it, or in this case, pretend as if I'm on this server. So what I'm going to do is go into the autoresponder tab. The autoresponder tab will let me feedback whatever response I want to a given request. When I've captured information on a session, it stores things into an SAZ file. So let's quickly capture into an SAZ file so you can see what I'm talking about. I'll just refresh this page. And you'll see that there are all of these different web requests that were made and the response that came back from them. So we can capture that. And if we save it, I can just file, save all sessions, and it will go into this SAV file or session archive. And then I can open that session archive from somewhere else. And I can do that in a couple of different ways. I can load the archive and show it. I have this in SkyDrive just in case. If I had one machine go down, I wouldn't kill all of my demos. and load it and see. I guess you'll find, I guess it's kind of hard to hide the guilty party here. Well then, I can see, they fixed it, so they're okay. I can see exactly what was happening. I can do the inquiry. I can see what request was made, what headers. I usually like viewing it as raw. Here's the raw request. Here's the raw response if I want to do some troubleshooting on that particular website. Great. So if I'm really good at troubleshooting, so good, in fact, that I can just look at HTML and solve problems, I probably need a raise. Turns out I'm not that good. So what I do instead is I actually have to use my troubleshooting tools. So with the autoresponder, enable automatic responses. Lets me intercept requests and replace them. One thing I always try to remember to do is to say, if it's not matched, please go ahead and pass it through to actually request it from the internet. Otherwise, I end up all kinds of confused. And then I can import that session archive. So I'll point this and pull in this demo script and open up this website. And now when I get the request for this particular web page, it will respond with the content as it existed there. That's super important for this demo because guess what? This is not available on the public internet. So I can't just go there and show it to you. But this connected, I can go through and do it. So think about the scenarios where that's helpful. Someone wants me to help troubleshoot an application. They can capture it and send it to me and say, here's the repro steps. Navigate to this URL, play this back, and you'll see this happen. So now I can grab the whole thing. Really, really cool that I'm able to do that. The other thing I can do is then just right-click on the top one and say, open the URL. And reproduce the bug. So here's the bug. So when thinking about debugging, something's not working, and I've got an error message saying, hey, there's something that's not working. And what do they advise you to do? Please check your Internet Explorer security settings and add to your trusted sites, because it's so easy to just do that. You know what? I'd rather not fix my code. I'd rather just say trusted sites. Trusted sites will fix it all, right? Let's try that. I'll just go to my security table, Ryan. Quick and easy. Maybe I can figure out why it needs trusted sites. But I'll just put it in here, and I'll just go ahead and add this in, remove that little rule, and see if obeying their directions gets me any further. I listened to you. You're still not working. So how do we troubleshoot that? Remember the golden rule. Always have a hypothesis before you go poking around. If you don't, just find your stick and start stirring up the hornet's nest. In this case, we have VBScript popping something up, which means we have a script probably running. So to me, it would be a matter of, well, my hypothesis is the script has a bug. See how good I am at making hypotheses? I think there's a bug in a script, as evidenced by the script error. This is why I get paid the big bucks. I'm going to put a stick in the hornet's nest and just say, you know what, let's start debugging, which will refresh the page. And didn't really help me, so I'm still debugging. Let me refresh again. There's the bug. Let me stop and see where I am in the script when that's running. Oh, really? You're not going to tell me? You are such a good debugging platform. All right, well, it's giving me the whole script here, though. So I can start exploring it and say, oh, unable to create scripting host ActiveX object. Please check. Okay, that's the error message that I saw. Trusted sites, blah, blah, blah. What's it trying to do before that? Set WSH shell equals create object WScript.shell. Is that a good idea from a web page? I think I heard one God no. Right? If we put a breakpoint on here, really? Source code not available for this location? Are you honestly going to give me that? Come on. There we go. So when I do this, F11 passed it. WSH shell, if I add this to my watch, I can see that it has nothing. It didn't make it. Why didn't it make it? Does anyone know? No, it actually can. Permissions. Right? So when we look at what's happening in ActiveX, right, and there's a long history behind it, and this history, understanding how we got to where we are can be a really powerful way of understanding how we can move further. In this case, the history is we wanted to create an extension mechanism that let you go beyond HTML. HTML, back in IE 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, didn't do a whole lot. Right? And as we started really embracing the web, right, so a couple years after the rest of the world embraced the web and we decided that seemed like it might be a good idea, let's embrace the web too. The reason why we really hadn't before was it didn't do everything we wanted software to do. So we figured out how could we go and add all of the bits of white space that the platform doesn't allow. That idea was ActiveX. Great. Let's add ActiveX control support. That's how we'll extend the browser. And then when you realize what happened, that's just dropping arbitrary DLLs into the iExport.exe process, which wanders the web that anyone can instantiate whenever they want to. And on XP, you're running as full admin, and so is your browser. That means that people can just run whatever the heck they want to whenever they want to by just putting it on a web page. That might not be a great idea. So then we came up with the idea next of, okay, well, let's not just let everyone who wants to drop new controls wherever they want to and instantiate them and run them. Let's let the people who make the controls determine whether or not you want to run it. Now, installing it, I have an event that's disruptive. It prompts it. But if I have the ability to script wscript.exe, I can run whatever command I want to and do what I want to. So we came up with this concept called safe for scripting. A way for the person who writes the control to say, this is okay to run from a web page. I designed it with that in mind, which is different from, hey, this is not okay to run from a web page, but it is okay to run from other applications that are already trusted. WScript can run anything it wants to and is not safe for scripting. And as a result, we don't let you instantiate it, trusted sites or not, because we start changing those rules. And we change them because it's irrational not to. When we look at the internet options, you have the ability in this zone to initialize and script ActiveX controls not marked as safe for scripting. And you have that control for every zone, right? And Aaron, who's right in the back there, wrote an article on this, which I consider to be required reading. Safe for scripting, Aaron. See how well that does. Not well. Oh, here we go. Hit number 3. I just love the way he describes it. Can get you hurt bad. And you actually demoed this at your web session, did you not? Yeah, so he gave a demo of how you could actively exploit this if you enable this. So we were able to, with a little bit of debugging and a little bit of internal knowledge, solve that. You are enabling this control. It's not marked as safe for scripting, so it doesn't get created. Now, of course, I elided the gap of, why is this not getting created? I'm looking and then tracing that out because I didn't realize that. That's the boring part to watch. Didn't figure that was really good conference material. But that's what you're trying to do in troubleshooting. Take your knowledge, take your what you know about the platform, learn more about the platform, and continue to apply it. Did you want to add something? You're not. Can we enable the microphones? And anyone else can jump up whenever you want to. It's the last session. We're here to have a good time.
So now go ahead and explain why this app was ever able to work.
Because they enabled that in that zone. All right.
Who
used to say
it?
Prompt. Because what normally happens, here's the pattern that I see with my enterprise customers, is that it's normally set to prompt to say, hey, and it gives you a question that no rational human can ever answer, which is, would you like to allow this thing to interact with other unsafe things in completely confusing language? And so they find that it does work if they click yes. They get annoyed at the fact that it's always asking, All right? They don't take it as a clue of, I might be doing something insecure. They take it as a clue of, wow, Windows is really annoying and likes to talk to me a lot. And then they turn that off and make it flat enable. We changed the defaults and made it to flat disable. Right, so lesson number one. Oh, did you want to add more?
I was just going to clarify that trusted sites used to have that set to prompt, if that wasn't clear from what Chris said. Back IE6 and earlier, trusted sites would give you a prompt when it hit that line, and you'd click yes. And so if you put stuff in trusted sites, then the site would work. But since IE7, that's not the default anymore.
Yep, and that is one of many rules. And so the first thing to be aware of is if you have ActiveX, and that's your clue, follow that clue. Because the rules on ActiveX have continued to get more and more restrictive because having unbounded extensibility opens up unbounded risk. So how do we do that? So safe for scripting was one thing that we did. We enabled something else that allowed a website developer to mark his web page his ActiveX control to only work on a particular web page. I'll give you an example of this, of another capability extension that we did in IE. Again, to kind of explain the direction. If you understand the directionality, it can get you started thinking, right? You will never know everything about IE, everything about Windows. It's not possible. If you begin to understand the directionality, you can start to be able to ask better questions. I've often thought that if someone else figures out that I'm a fraud and all I do is web searches, that I wouldn't have my job anymore. Because that's most of what I do. But I know how to ask good questions. Right? ActiveX, here's a fun ActiveX control. This is designed to model the resiliency of the browser. If one of my controls brings down the browser, we'll just bring you right back. And it can bring it down again, and we'll eventually say, it looks like this web page sucks. Would you like to go anywhere else? Neat for a demo, but think about what power this ActiveX control gives you. Gives you the ability to crash someone's browser whenever you want to. It's marked as safe for scripting, so it won't be blocked. There is no prompt. It'll just run. Throw an object tag in there, and you'll crash the page. People writing this control probably didn't want to be the ones who infected every single Microsoft demo machine with a please crash my browser command that the rest of the world can exploit. So what they used was the ability to lock a website to a particular domain. This is a Windows Azure website, Windows Azure hosted. So it has a cloudapp.net address, IE8 demo site. I think it has one too many S's. Cloudapp.net, the exact same site. But because it's a different site, number one, we're going to say, hey, you've never run this control on this page. Do you want to opt in for this website? I'll say, OK, sure. But then we still won't crash because we use site lock on it to say, don't work on any site other than this one. This is not IE8demos.com. SiteLock blocks it from working. So the developer can control that. You've got developer controls and admin controls. That's the directionality of ActiveX. So that example is one where we talk about where the policies are coming in. I'm going to try again on the other one. All right, you're working again. Mark must have captured his number one position, so we went ahead and gave him authorization to open it up. So policies. And I wanted to start off talking about policies, because what we found lately is that the way that people configure their browser is often the biggest source of challenge around compatibility. Around 10% of the bugs that get escalated to my team, which is responsible to be the final escalation point for Windows apps or IE apps that aren't working, around 10% of the IE escalations that come to us where they eventually demonstrate that the web application actually works just fine on a vanilla install of IE 8 or 9 or whichever one they're going to, but doesn't work as soon as they domain join and apply their policies. Right? So in this case, we had one that was broken unless you loosened up your policies. Here's an example where we've added a policy that ends up breaking it. So now it's not that the default policies are restrictive, it's that we've added more things on here. Oh, did they really fix this? That is really going to annoy me. All right, so this is now a failed demo, which is what you get when you do the live stuff. And apparently, in fixing it, yes. Okay, well, I'll tell you what the demo was, which is nowhere near as effective as it used to be. Is that previously the default... Oops, no, not that. Hold on, let me turn that back off. That'll really mess up the rest of the day. Tracking protection. Oh, that's why I don't have it installed in here. Someone noticed that if you use tracking protection, I'll go install it and break the website. That's why it's broken. Tracking protection, a policy you can add. I'm going to add the easy list, because those are the ones that break it, I'm pretty sure. And now it's broken. Right? There's a consequence of adding new rules and adding new policies that block things, some of them unintended. One of my favorite, I hate to keep singling Aaron out because it gives him a big head, but he gave a great presentation that's recorded somewhere. Is it recorded publicly? Called The Unintended Consequences of Security Lockdowns. That talks about things where it seems like a good idea, but there are things that you didn't mean to have happen that happened as a result. It seemed like a good idea to stop having people track me. I don't like being tracked. It seems like a bad idea to be unable to use the schedule builder. How would I debug that? I can see right in the console. So this is a great tool for starting things out. If you're not familiar with the F12 tools, we added them for IE8. We enhanced them greatly for IE9. There are a few additional changes in IE10. None as sweeping as the IE9 additions. But it will output, hey, a download was blocked. This JavaScript, which drives the schedule builder, is blocked by the trusty tracking protection list. Because it's apparently used for tracking along the way. I'm not sure if that's a false positive or negative. But again, this is part of the configuration, which is bringing you a breakage. Let's debug. You want to do more IE or Windows? Windows? All right. Let's get into a Windows app. What can we do there? You know what I'm going to do? I want to do it. It's not really debugging per se, but it's using some of the tools that you'd use to understand a problem to showcase an aspect of UAC, because this is one of the conversations I end up having a lot. I think it's one of the most misunderstood technologies that we have right now. And I think even experts struggle to understand all of the ramifications. It is that different. And along the way, explain a few of the concepts that go into UAC and begin to explain it. So here's a couple of executables that implement a pattern, which is to separate elevation out using COM. Right, so the rules of UAC. If you want to elevate an application, you are always starting a new process. You never elevate in place. So if you see a UAC prompt, it's because someone's starting a new application. Incidentally, there are only three reasons why you'll ever see that UAC prompt. And it's never because we looked at what the application was doing and decided you needed one. It is either because the developer asked for it specifically via an XML manifest, because the IT admin asked for it specifically by putting it in a shim database, or because we think it's a setup. Those are the only reasons UAC prompts ever appear. So if you see one and you want to make it go away, you should first ask yourself, hey, maybe you're wrong about it being a setup. The COM elevation process says we will create an out-of-process elevated COM component, which rather conveniently also gives you some wiring with which to communicate it. So we get a new process, but we get RPC for free. So a lot of people embrace that approach. If I'm going to have an elevated comm component handle my task that requires elevation for me, I have two options with which to approach that. I could either have the application host the UI collecting the protected information, or I can have the out-of-process comm component host the UI. And if we're thinking about just keeping that information, which that bit of task that requires elevation in there, I may choose to take this approach of, I'll keep the UI in my non-elevated process, that means less code running elevated, and feed that to the comm component. Good idea, huh? With one slight caveat. Let's say I'm a bad guy. I'm not running as admin. I would like to do whatever thing you're designed to do. You gave me a window that gives me input for that. Let me go ahead and click that for you. And now I've used UI automation to drive that. It turns out that we actually have protection for that in the operating system through a feature called User Interface Privilege Isolation, that if you send a window message to any other window, is this review for everyone, or is this some of this new stuff? So-so, it's a refresher at least, right? So here's the idea. Windows messages are how we communicate back and forth between windows. Windows messages do not have security descriptors. So any window can send a message to any other window on that desktop. Desktops do have security descriptors, so you've got to get on there. So any app can send a message to any other app and drive it and provide that UI automation. And with no security descriptor, that means you can drive anything else. So we added a feature to help protect against that. That feature is called User Interface Privilege Isolation. What we do is we look at the integrity level of every process. So by default, a process running as a standard user or as a protected administrator runs with medium integrity. If you elevate, it runs with high. Services typically, though not always, run at system. And protected mode, as implemented by Internet Explorer, by Office 2010 Protected View, by Google Chrome, by Adobe Reader 10, and also by Metro applications, runs in low integrity. There's more to isolation in Metro apps, and there will be all kinds of details, I'm sure, coming out about that. In this case, if I look at what we're doing here, I've created this UI from the elevated process, so it's running at high integrity. The attacker is just running as me, so he's running at medium integrity. When I try to send a window message from a low integrity or medium integrity application to a high integrity application, it just never gets there. We drop them. There are a couple that we whitelist. You can whitelist more of their APIs to do that, but that's how we protect that. Now you can't crack it. I point this out not because I wanted to have a little UAC jam session, but to say, please keep talking about UAC, because there are still people who don't understand it. Let me give an example of a little applet created by someone that doesn't implement the correct pattern. So the act of changing the time zone, starting with Windows Vista, no longer requires administrator rights. Technically, they put a privilege on there. I don't know that we need a full-on privilege for that, but the idea is standard users should be able to hork all their own stuff, but not someone else's stuff. Admins can hork everyone's stuff, right? That's the general rule of thumb. Changing the time zone messes it up for everyone. So, okay, now that you could potentially kind of confuse or annoy someone by making them late to their meetings or stuff, but it's not the worst thing in the world, and it actually is much, much worse than being able to say that anyone who gets on a plane routinely is going to always be looking at the wrong time. That's the worst outcome. So we added a privilege and made it possible. This is not elevated, but changing the system time still requires elevation, because changing the system time has a lot of impact on other users, including potentially making them unable to log into the computer because you fall outside of tolerance with the server, which breaks Kerberos. So it's an admin operation. So here's system time, an admin operation, right? What's hosting this? Run DLL 32 running at medium. So who doesn't completely understand UAC yet? Us. We work on the Windows team. We make UAC, and we make some of these mistakes. And that's not because we're dumb. It's because this stuff is genuinely hard. How did we find out? Process Explorer. Right? So I didn't introduce that. Mark, you know, I heard a lot of people talking about Mark session, but Process Explorer lets me explore that. Super easy for me to find that. All right, let's dig into something else.
Can I just point out one thing about having elevated stuff on a desktop? There is no firm security boundary between medium and high integrity processes running on a single desktop. And so the best rule of thumb is when you want to do administration, don't do it on an untrusted standard user desktop. Do it through some other means, like through a system agent or a completely separate desktop, full admin desktop.
Okay. Just saying. Thank you, Aaron.
Anytime, Chris.
More debugging. This was an interesting one. Windows debugging is actually a little bit easier for me because people don't update their websites. This is one, DQS installer.exe. Let's see who makes that. See, I can probably just go to properties and find out who makes that. So what is this guy? Interesting. So the SQL Server team for SQL Server 2012 reached out to me because their app wasn't working. They couldn't install their software, right? They work for Microsoft, right? Couldn't get it installed. They were doing their searches. Let's hope they were Bing searches because they do work for us. And eventually found my blog talking about something that sounded similar. So they said, hey, listen, can you help us out? Mailed me this executable and said, what do I do about that? Because that's kind of annoying me, right? This is a typical awesome Windows error message. It's side-by-side configuration is incorrect. Please save the app event log or use the command line sxstrace.exe tool for more detail. And they had absolutely no clue what it was talking about. Let's actually go and see. I don't actually know if the event viewer shows me anything, but we can go find out. Which one do they want me to look into? The application event log. So let's go in here and see, does it tell me side by side? Error in manifest or policy file, see user, blah, blah, blah. Oh, Windows 8 actually gives me a better error message than Windows 7 did. Invalid XML syntax. So one thing we do keep trying to do better is improving our error messages, because let's face it, it's hard to do worse. So it looks like there's a problem in the XML syntax. So the question is, what is the problem? Right? So when thinking about this particular problem, I had to figure out, well, which tool would I use to do that? Right? So it looks like there's an error in side-by-side, which tells me manifest, right? Because I know that, right? Knowledge in my brain combined with situation. I become aware and I build a hypothesis. There's something wrong with it. Now I even have an event log entry in Windows 8 saying it's bad XML syntax, even more helpful. How would I go and explore and figure out what's wrong? And what I would do in the past was I would go, I haven't installed PE Browse, and I would extract the manifest using the manifest tool, or mt.exe, part of the SDK, which is a lot of work, and it turns out I'm really lazy. So there's another tool, which I used to use as a demo tool, PE Browse Professional, which lets me go in and look at that. It's called PE Browse. And it's, I'm going to go with the, let's see, do I need the 64-bit one? 64-bit XE? We'll see what happens. I'll just install it in real time. Ooh, you're unrecognized. More info. Run it anyway. That is reputation. How many of you are familiar with app reputation on Windows or on IE? That I just cavalierly clicked past. If you are writing software, that's super important to know about. Here's what we do. When you create an application and release it on the web and download it, right? So it's got Mark of the Web on it. We're going to look to a reputation server to say, is this something that's often done right? This is going against our historical roots of blacklists, which say, hey, this is known to be bad, and adds to it a dimension of not many people look at this. So this isn't known to be bad or good. It's just kind of not known. This one is clearly not known. Now, you can build a reputation by having more and more people download you and not complain that it's bad. And eventually, you get the reputation. If you digitally sign it, then the signature builds the reputation. Right? So this is something to be mindful of, because this is going to be on IE9. And it's going to be in Windows 8 also. So you can see that Windows itself is getting involved, saying, hey, this is something kind of new. And it's no one really knows much about it, so let me go ahead and give you a chance to opt out. This one's not signed. There is no signature on it. So now, if it's not signed, I have to build the reputation for the hash of the binary, and every time I update it, reputation goes away. If I sign it, I build a reputation for my signature, and the signature then signed on something else transfers its reputation to that. So PE Browse, I don't know if the 64-bit one will work. Oops, I just closed it for some reason. And if it doesn't, I'll install the 32-bit one. And I'll open, where is this guy? This is on my SkyDrive, demos, Windows, and here's the installer. And this will give me details. Wow, that's a horrible font. Does it let me change fonts? Of course not. That would be too helpful. It will dissect and show me the contents of what's in this executable, which I use to kind of explore, well, what is in a Windows binary? Help me understand what's there. And I use it for demos to help people understand what Windows does. But what I wanted to go after here specifically was I wanted to understand exactly what was going on in that manifest. So in this case, here is the manifest. It shows up under resource ID number 24, which I happen to know is rt_manifest. So the tool doesn't yet translate manifest files, because apparently he hasn't, in the past 6 years, had time to go ahead and update that support. But the neat thing that I can do is I can, oh, you're not going to let me extract it? Ugh. Board? See you at the party. All right, I'm going to download the one that I know, because that lets me extract. Yes, yes, here it is again. We protected you. It has no reputation. That's OK. So this lets me dissect, see what's going on inside. I can go in and see that manifest. And let me open this guy up again. And this is going to be, I'll throw this off of my SkyDrive, demos, Windows, DQS installer, right? Because I'm trying to hurry up, right? They sent me a message. They really want me to help out. They want to ship the product. They can't install it. That's a bit of a problem for them. So what can we do to help them out? So I said, all right, well, here's the manifest. And it kind of looks not too terrible just in this hex view. But I'm not a master of hexadecimal. I have met people who do that. One of my favorite stories, and he loves when I tell this because it makes him look like a superhero. A guy's name was Robert Page. He was one of the developers and troubleshooters who was on the AEBIT team, the Application Experience Bug Investigation team. And I had something that had me stumped. And we had this rule of priority one interrupt. If you're truly stumped and need someone, you'll walk into someone's office. And I walked in. I said, I'm stuck. And I don't even have a question for you. Come look at it. So he walks over. I'm describing the problem. He doesn't even sit down. He stands behind my machine. He dumps hex on the screen, points to some of it, and says, apply this. And he walks out of the room confident that he had the answer. And he actually did have the answer. And it horrified me. He confessed later that he'd actually just debugged something an awful lot like that, like literally half an hour beforehand, so it was fresh of mind, and he was just really trying to mess with me. So I'm going to extract this so I can look at it in a text editor. So I'm going to call this, DQS installer.xe.manifest. Drop it on my desktop and take a look at it in Notepad++. So I'm taking a look at it, and I'm like, okay, well, I see something that's a bit unusual. What's this garbage? I think, you know, it says invalid XML. I didn't have that clue, but I had side-by-side configuration, and I've got garbage characters sitting in it, right? And again, applying macro knowledge, rule of thumb about Windows to keep in mind when things sort of behave unexpectedly, why they're behaving unexpectedly. We've had a big architectural initiative across Windows to refactor the whole operating system into a series of layers. To a large part because it was darn near impossible to compile the thing, right? Because you had all these dependencies. You would have binary A depending upon binary B, and then some other function of binary B would depend right back on binary A. And they'd be all across the stack, had all these interdependencies, and we had this idea of building like Windows Core, or MinWin, all these other sort of experimental things. We had this overall challenge of, you know, all right, well, we need to get some more architectural purity. It evolved naturally. Let's take what we have and refactor it into layers. We're not going to have it perfect, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but we just grouped it into layer 0, layer 1, layer 2, layer 3, layer 4. Create process, probably not surprisingly, is in layer 0. XML parsing and MS XML is not. So we're not using XML to read this, which means we are implementing XML parsing in order to support manifests inside of a layer 0 component, which means it's probably not super full-featured. And therefore, error handling is not of super paramount importance other than don't crash. Incidentally, we didn't have the don't crash part fixed up until a particular service pack in XP. We got that one fixed up for XP, though, eventually. When you redeclare default namespaces, it didn't handle that well at all. And just, again, it's not all of MS XML, so it didn't inherit all of its robustness. So I thought that was the problem. But here's the thing. You don't want to say something's the solution and be wrong, because now you've wasted their time again. So the question then becomes, if I'm right or wrong, what could I do? And one option is that I could go in and I could extract the manifest, edit it, and push the manifest back in. If I do that, what have I done to the binary? I've invalidated the digital signature precisely right, and that may cause it to behave differently. But if I just wanted to test the manifest format, the question was, how can I do that? What's the fastest tool, right? Be lazy. You just need some way to prove or disprove your theory. My theory is two bad characters. How can I find out? It's just a manifest. It doesn't have to be modifying this binary. It just has to be modifying a binary. In one of the very few clever moments I've had, I thought, I know of some unmanifested binaries inside of this little folder here called stockviewer.exe. What if I took one of these guys? So I took this one. I'll make a copy of it so I don't mess it up too much. I said, okay, here's this stockviewercontrolpanel.exe. Let's say a rename. Let's grab all of the characters, and then let's rename this guy so it matches this one. So now this will be manifesting this control. That works only because stockviewercontrolpanel.exe doesn't already have a manifest. On Windows XP and earlier, if I put a app.xe.manifest side by side, it had precedence over the internal one. Windows Vista and later, the internal manifest has precedence over the external one. Incidentally, that is the one and only time in all of recorded history, and probably will only be the time, that I have won a technical argument with Mark Rusinovich, who insisted that we never looked at external ones because of Visual Studio's behind-the-back injection of manifests. So thank you to the product team for letting me win just one argument. But because this has none, it will pick up the external one. And so when I do this, I'm going to make Stock Viewer Control Panel break in the same way the other app broke. Now I can start trying to fix it. So my idea was, all right, so I think that I know the problem. Let's get rid of these two garbage characters, or three garbage characters. Just delete them. Try it again. I did. Doesn't actually fix it. See? Grayed out. I love Notepad++, by the way. I'm a huge fan. I don't know why we don't put in a great Notepad, but I also appreciate the start time of Notepad. It didn't fix it. So there's my hypothesis. Turned out I was wrong. But I had a hunch I was on the right track, because clearly when I applied that manifest to something else, it caused it to break. So my theory was incomplete, but on the right track. So then I had to figure out what else was wrong. Here's the other thing I'd never seen before in an XML manifest, the copyright. I had not seen a copyright before. And I thought to myself, I've never seen a comment being used before. Maybe the comment's the problem. Again, we don't have a full-featured XML parser. So taking these rules together, I don't know all of them, but I know about layering. It implies create process is different. It implies all these other things that I can kind of assemble together and go, that's probably the problem. What happens if I delete that? Now it works as expected. Hypothesis, tool, and be unconventional. Right? This is the hardest thing when I talk to the nerds at Microsoft and the geeks. Different cultures have different preference over which one is the preferable term, whichever one you find most favorable. But the challenge that I have is that there is such geek cred around using WinDBG and the most sophisticated tools to solve things that they intentionally look for excuses to go wandering off into them. I did a session at our internal conference called Tech Ready, where I took one troubleshooting problem, which you could solve in about 36 hours, I know because I did it, using the debugger. You can also solve it in about 8 minutes by never touching a debugger, never touching a tool, but by asking a series of good questions and making subtle changes in how things are organized. They hated it, because I didn't take the 36-hour way. But you need to be smart. I thought that was, first of all, every now and then I do something clever like that, and I can't believe that I actually came up with that. I can't imagine myself coming up with it today, but it was an elegant, fast solution, and we're shipping SQL Server 2012, thanks to AppCompat guys. See? We are changing the world. We ship SQL Server. We should go tell them that. And it wasn't for us. It wouldn't be shipping. All right, what else should we do? Oh, this was another fun one. I'll show you the hard way and the easy way. I, of course, did it the hard way. I occasionally do. I try to tell myself, stop, think of other ways to do it. This one I did the hard way. An application called SQLNav. It's awesome. Don't you enjoy it? Let's go to it again. Let's navigate down off of the C drive. And I think I stuck it under here for some reason. Here, let's make it bigger. Extra large icons. Well, that really helps that one. Okay, so here's the problem. This is SQL Navigator for Oracle by Quest Software. Is there anyone from Quest here? All right. You got a bug in your software. We're going to debug it for you. It's been fixed a long time ago. I'm just teasing you. This is like version 5. I'm not sure what the current version is. It's for Oracle, so I don't use it either. I don't have that much of a tolerance for smell. So this was the symptoms that were manifest.
So I thought, okay, that's not so cool. I can't tell what's going on. Someone said where I should go first. I have no idea. I need to stir the pot, take my stick, poke it in there, stir it around, see what happens. So what am I going to do? When in doubt, use... You guys are long-winded. Procmon. You can use ProcessMon, but Procmon's faster, and I'm lazy. See, you got to be lazy. Oh, that's awesome. I don't have it indexed yet. All right. I keep it on my SkyDrive, so it'll be easy to find. Let's go to SkyDrive. Whoops, I missed that hit target. There we go. And go into Programs and just Internal, so I make sure it's everywhere I want to be. And go to Procmon. Fire it up. Wow, I've not launched it on this machine. That's pretty funny. And try to figure out what's going on. So now I got Procmon running. I'll launch the app. That worked really well. And stop monitoring it to stop the assault of data. And let's start poking and pulling apart and adding a filter to show me just that stuff where the process name is SQL nav to make sure it's actually starting, and there it is. It is starting up. We'll add it in there, click apply, say OK, and oh, hey, we are getting a process start. We're getting a thread create. We're doing a bunch of stuff. We're doing a bunch of stuff, and we get to the end, and we've got a process exit. I love the fact the process exit status is zero. Everything is fine. So, well, yes, blocking people from using Oracle is usually a good idea. I'm just teasing. There's going to be someone from Oracle here who's going to come up and punch me in the face. And there will be much applause from those who've actually met me. So anyway, so here was the challenge, right? I didn't know what it was. I wanted to pick a stick and poke it in there and see what was going on. So I went to the end. I said it exited gracefully, which means it hit something that it knew to look for. So it wasn't just AVing. And said, oh, I can't work if this doesn't happen, so let me go ahead and bow out. Now, they could have arguably at least told you something like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and go away now rather than just not appearing. But, you know, at least they are handling it. Good air handling, right? So positive. Thumbs up for that. Now, what happened? And I didn't have to dig that far back to find out what was going on. So I went one screen back and said, okay, here's what's happening. Create file. C colon whack toad debug.txt, access denied, and then as soon as that happens, I start having all kinds of teardown behavior, and then I exit the process. Sounds to me like I hit a problem, and I need to access that file. And if I can't, then I'm going to go ahead and fail. So my theory was, well, let's try redirecting that, right? So what I could do is I could loosen the ACLs on the root of C, which I will do over my dead body. So option number two was, let's put that somewhere else. So we're going to use our old friend's shims to solve that, and one of the most annoying shims ever, because it is really, really difficult to use well. Super powerful, but really hard to use correctly. So let's fire up. C. Compatibility administrator, it's a 32-bit application. And I'm going to make a new fix for SQL nav by quest. SkyDrive, demos, Windows, and here we go. Actually, no. Hold on. This is installed. Program files. Expense it. SQL nav. And I'm going to redirect that somewhere else where I won't get the access denied. So I'm going to use correct file paths. Correct file paths. Let me put in a command line. I want to redirect everything that requests for this, semicolon, where do I want to put it? User app data. And I'll just put it in toad debug.txt there. Why not? Save that. We'll call this TechEd. Drop this on the desktop. And install the database. And now we're going to fix it up because I'm never unlucky. Still nothing. I'm like, it sounded like a good idea to me, right? And how it actually played out was that there was a consultant who was doing this work who was reaching out to me for help. And because I apparently don't require sleep, we were having this conversation. I'm like, try this. He's like, I tried it. It doesn't work. When correct file paths doesn't work, there's one of two reasons, typically. Number one, because whatever binary is writing that file lives in System32, because the System32 directory by default is excluded from being shimmed, because Windows itself shouldn't need to be shimmed. But sometimes you want binaries that live there to have the shims applied to them. For example, Visual Basic 6. Everything goes through msvbvm60.dll. For another example, MSXML I've seen, where we route through there, and so I need to apply the shim there. Reason number one is I haven't hit something. Whoa, don't look down. Hit something that needs to be shimmed up. So I tried that first, and that didn't help. So reason number two is that there's something wrong in my path. It's not matching, because here's the thing. Correct file paths gets in every single create file call and all kinds of other files. It's all in the documentation. Lots and lots of APIs. Turns out we touch the disk a lot. So if we spend time going through and normalizing every single file name that passes through, we're going to waste a lot of CPU cycles when most of the time we don't match. We have to be heavily performance optimized. Otherwise, you apply the shim and all of a sudden performance degrades to unacceptable levels. So we need to be really, really precise, annoyingly precise, frustratingly precise. So when it didn't fix it, my first guess was try applying include star. Then my second guess was, all right, well, there's something wrong with the path. So when I went through and launched it again, I said, OK, there's something wrong with the path. Maybe that's the problem. Let's find out the exact path that's put there. Because while Process Monitor is indeed amazing, Process Monitor is a kernel mode driver. This name has been normalized already by the time we get there. I don't know what we passed into the API. Conveniently, they're using create file A, which makes it super easy for me to go and put a breakpoint on that. So I'm going to launch my 32-bit debugger and launch this application. This is exactly what I did. I'll show you the much easier way later, and you guys will be like, wow, you were an idiot to have done it the hard way. Open executable and expense it. And SQL nav 5. So, yeah, sure, why not? Right, and the first thing I do is change the font because I hate fonts that are not TrueType fonts because bitmap fonts look horrible. Call me a perfectionist. I won't disagree with you. Let's make it a bigger 14. Is that easy? Is that good enough to read? Gorgeous? That's hot. I need some time alone with your debugger now. So I went in here and said, all right, so let's do a breakpoint on kernel 32, create file A. Kernel 21 will not be nearly as effective. Breakpoint list, there's my breakpoint. So I got into a debugger, I'm poking around, I'm thinking, if that were create file W, I'd be hosed, because all of Windows uses that too, so that thing is called a billion times. Create file A, I thought it was early enough that maybe I'll get lucky and not hit it too many times. Go, I hit the breakpoint, here's where I am. And I'm inside of this little bit of code. Let's see what argument I passed. Oops, that's not the right argument. Neither is that one. All right, so let's not waste too much time. We'll do a all right. This will be fun. Live interactive debugging. See, this is one you think you ought to have possibly rehearsed. I'm just kidding. I rehearse like crazy, but I also leave some things up to chance. Stop. Why are you researching everything? Oh, it's pulling down symbols. That'll be fun. Here I am inside of this application. So let me actually get into it. Let me step in. And I'm inside of the shim. So let me look at what we passed. So here we are, create file A. Here is the argument that was passed. Toad debug.txt with just a slash. Remember how I said that correct file paths was annoying? C:// does not match slash. So it's different and doesn't match and doesn't get replaced. So how do we fix it? We need to use the actual argument that's being passed in. Right, so I've gone through a debugger, I found this thing, I use procmon, and I found that thing. I'll go in and edit the fix, right-click, edit application fix, next, show me the selected, give me the parameters. I'm going to replace this and do it with just a slash, say OK, finish, save, right-click, install, and try launching it again, and find that the application launches. That's how I solved it. Thinking it through, what's the problem? I know correct file paths is annoying. It's so annoying that I know people who are fantastic at AppCompat that refuse to use it unless there's no other alternative because it's so difficult to use. Powerful, but it requires you to be super precise and know that you've solved the problem completely. Now let me show you the better way to solve that problem. I had someone who had a similar problem. They were, rather inconveniently, in Jordan. And I was not. But they had a very similar problem where they had an application that wasn't launching, and it was something they had to troubleshoot, and they were not proficient with the debugger. So it didn't take me too long in the debugger to solve that out. For them, it would have been a bit of a challenge. Right? It was not their job to live in WinDBG. So I had to think of some way to help them get through that more easily. Here's what I came up with. A little utility called Lua Buglight. And I'm going to go into the Buglight reporter. And I had them collect this data with Lua Buglight. I said file, open report file, and SkyDrive, demos, Windows. Oh, it's zipped up. Here's the XML file. It was doing the exact same thing. We had an access denied, tried to fix it using correct file paths. It didn't get fixed. Without using a debugger, using a free tool called Lua Buglight, we were able to capture all of the same events and notice how in the event details, we gather an extremely important bit of information, the actual parameter passed to the API, and notice how that little slash mark is going the wrong way, so it's not an exact match, so we didn't replace it, so we didn't fix the app. We added the exact match, we got it going, and boom, the application lit up again. And no debugger required. Always look for ways that your tools can be used and be aware. Right? It's great to be full of geek cred, but it's also great to be able to go home at night. Right? There's plenty of stuff you can debug. Don't worry, we're not going to run out. You know, but let's be smart about things. And for the last one, I'm going to go back to the browser just because this is one that's driving me nuts and because there was actually someone from GE Healthcare who said he might stop by here. Are you here? Anyone from GE Healthcare? All right, well, maybe they'll watch the recording. I'll pick on him again. He doesn't make this one. He's like, yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I'm like, yeah, I'll debug it again. This is the application, so a little bit of history on this one. Buddy of mine from college, who I used to do to, he was one of my drinking buddies because I had a lot of those. I'm really good at that, it turns out. He went on to become the director of functional and stereotactic neurosurgery at Northwestern University. So we've got a great deal going on. Every time I need my brain operated on, he takes care of me. Every time he needs his computer fixed, I take care of him. Thus far, he's really coming out ahead. Some would argue perhaps we should be more even. But this application I have debugged for IE8, for IE9, and guess what happened for IE10? Here's the fun part. And it's the same bug we had in 9. I'm like, really, how could this be broken again? Your version of MS Script Engine is not sufficient. Centricity Enterprise Web will not function correctly. What version do you have? 10. All right, and interestingly enough, it turns out that if I go into the F12 tools and pick the browser mode, if I say IE9, that doesn't fix it. If I lie and say I'm IE8, that doesn't fix it. It works on all these browsers. If I say IE7, that doesn't fix it. It's already in Quarks mode, so that's probably not going to fix it. So I'm kind of thinking, all right, there's no easy solution. I'm going to have to divert to code. Always, always, always look for solutions that don't require code first, because they're faster. That doesn't mean don't fix them. That means try to avoid writing code. In this case, we had to do something with code. So I wanted to go in and look at that, and because I've got 3 minutes, I'm going to kind of cut to the chase. I found, he wasn't too much help in this department. Checks.js. We drill into this one. Let's actually extract this. So we'll go ahead and save the response, just the body, to the desktop. And we'll call it checks.js. And take a look at the logic. I'll show you their fantastic fix for IE9. Right, so the word sufficient is pretty unique. And that's actually adding the test results role, so I'll actually find the script. There we go, perfect. Add test results row. So here's the logical check that was failing, and this one was failing on IE9, worked on IE8. What version was the script engine in IE6? Up to 5.6. But IE7? IE8, all version 5.0 script engine. What do we do in IE9? We revved the script engine to be 9.0. Is 9 greater than or equal to 5? Yep. Everyone's like thinking, like, dude, you got like a minute. You're going to make me think? We're done. Is 0 greater than or equal to 5? No. So this fails. They tried to do the right thing. I want 5.5 or greater, thinking that logic would catch everything. And it actually caught everything that existed when they wrote it, and it rolls over and dies when you write anything else. Incidentally, this logical error is precisely the reason why Windows 7 is version 6.1 and Windows 8 is version 6.2. Because 1 is greater than 1, greater than or equal to 1, which is XPs, and 2 is greater than or equal to 1, which is XPs. Honestly, because more apps work that way. I don't make this stuff up. So then I'm like, well, how does it work on 9? I'm like, oh, they added a fix. Here's their fix. I actually gave them the fix. I've presented on this so many times. It's recorded on like 9 different webcasts where I've debugged this problem for IE9. And here it is for IE10 failing again because they checked major version and minor version equal to 9.0. The funny part is the major version will never be equal to 9.0. So we actually have to round it because the major version's 9, the minor version's 0. Good thing they put an or in there. please stop writing version checks. Don't write it. The right way is not to do it. Right? And I know that there are some situations where you have to, but certainly this is not the right way to approach it. But that one we could fix up the right way. I could edit the code, but I have 11 seconds. So with that, I would like to say grab your stuff, drop it off at the hotel, get ready to drink lots of beer because it's time to cut loose and have a great time. Thank you very much. Hope you had a great Tech Ed.